We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. One of Harvard University's most popular courses is taught by political philosopher Michael Sandel. It is known informally as Justice, and it tackles some of the most pressing questions of our day, questions about how we should live and what, if anything, government should have to say about it. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking with Michael Sandel about his recently published book, Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? In this book, he tries, as he does in the classroom, to show how reasoned moral argument can help make sense of both politics and our own beliefs. Our guest, Michael Sandel, is the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard University, where he has taught since 1980. He is the author of a number of books, including Justice, which is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's also the basis for a documentary that will air on many public television stations titled Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? It's a collaboration between Harvard and the public station, the big public station in Boston, WGBH. There's also a website for the show if you're interested in finding out more about it, which is justiceharvard.org. As we talk this morning in this hour with Michael Sandel, questions are welcome from people who are listening, and they are certainly the phone lines are open if people want to call and participate and share their thoughts and ask questions. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief so that we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. Just keep that in mind. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Sandel, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. I would imagine that probably there aren't many other philosophy courses there at Harvard, or probably too many other places where students will line up in the numbers that they have to take your course. And I guess I wonder what it is you think about the course or maybe the subject that is so engaging for students.
I think the real appeal, David, is that students, and not only students but citizens generally, I think are eager to try to sort through some of the big questions of moral and political philosophy to figure out what they believe and why. In the course and also in the book, I deal with what some of the famous philosophers have written about justice, going all the way back to Aristotle and up to John Stuart Mill and a number of other philosophers. But I try to connect what those philosophers have to say with the moral dilemmas and the political arguments we have today, whether it's about bailouts and bonuses or health care, same-sex marriage or affirmative action or income distribution. In the course and in the book, I try to connect the big ideas of justice and rights and the common good with these very contemporary issues on which students and citizens generally do have strong opinions. So I think it's that opportunity, really, it's a journey of self-exploration in a way to figure out what really do we believe and how should we face these hard moral and political choices.
Yeah. I am guessing that when presented with the kind of hypotheticals that you use in the book and you use in the course, that most people, you give them a certain situation, you say, here's the situation now, what's the right thing to do?
Yes.
And I'm guessing that probably most people would actually have an answer. They wouldn't just throw up their hands and say, well, I don't know. But then when you ask them, as I'm sure you do, why is it that you think that's the answer, then it becomes a little bit more difficult because people have to think about, well, why is it that I think that's it? And I'm interested in where you think, how it is that people, you know, that you're going to have to get them to think about them to articulate why it is they think, but they do have an answer, and where that comes from, what it is that it informs people's moral choices that operates at some sort of a level that may almost be a little bit below their consciousness?
Well, it's a very interesting question, David, how this actually works. And what, in a way, what you're really asking is what is the source of the moral and political convictions we have, and what actually goes on when we try to persuade other people or when we try to figure out for ourselves how to reconcile seeming contradictions in our views. Shall I give you a concrete example?
Yes, please.
To show how this works?
Mm-hmm.
In the book and in the course, I talk, one example is about military service and military conscription. And I point out that during the Civil War, there was a draft. It was the very first draft we had. But if you were drafted and didn't want to go fight in the Civil War, you could hire a substitute to take your place. You could run an ad in the newspaper and hire someone to go fight for you. So in the book, I pose the question, is this fair? And I put this question in the course to the students. Most students say, no, it's not fair. To make it very concrete, Andrew Carnegie, among others, opted out by paying someone else to serve for them. So most say, no, it's not fair. And then I ask the reason, just as you say. And most people say, well, it's not fair because it's there seems something unjust with the affluent paying those who may be less privileged to risk their lives and fight for their country, and they, the affluent, stay at home. Then I ask them, so that's the reason they give. Then I try to test that reason by saying, okay, what about today's all-volunteer army? Could it be argued, how many favored the all-volunteer army? And almost everyone in the class raises his or her hand. And then I ask, well, what about the objection that most of you had to the buyout provision, hiring a substitute during the Civil War? Does that objection, that principle, that it's not right that the affluent hire other people to sacrifice for them in fighting their wars, does that principle call into question the fairness of the current all-volunteer army? Can you reconcile the two? And then the discussion, we're off and running with the discussion, and students and offer reasons, ways of reconciling the two, though some come to the conclusion that actually the principle that made me uneasy about the Civil War buyout system actually may raise some serious questions about the system we have now. So that would be an example, just as you say, David, of how the reasons for the view that we may have on a given topic may actually force us to reconsider or to examine a view on another issue that we thought we had settled.
Yeah. Our guest, just very quickly, let me reintroduce again our guest, Michael Sandel. He's professor of government at Harvard University, where he's taught since 1980. He's the author of a number of books, including most recently Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and it is kind of based on a course that he has been teaching at Harvard for a number of years now, a very popular course that does just what he just explain. It tries to get people to think about what is the right thing to do in a number of situations, what they think the right thing to do is, why they think that's the right thing to do, and also perhaps looks at how various people over time who had different philosophical orientations, how they answered these kinds of questions, because his point is very much that while some of the questions that we're wrestling with now may seem new, that I think he would argue that people have indeed been wrestling with these questions, the same questions, for a very long time.
Yes.
Right. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, you talk in the book about how people have how thinkers, philosophers have approached these questions over time. And it seems that there's a basic sort of a conflict here, and it's been there maybe for some time, at least in the last few hundred years, probably. And that is this idea that on the one hand, there is some notion of public good,
right,
which is not easy to define, but there's some notion of public good that sometimes trumps individual rights. On the other hand, there is, for some people, a very, very important principle of freedom that says, you know, the greatest good is served actually when people are free to make free choices.
Yeah.
And while the two things are linked, it also seems that they pull in opposite directions. And
yeah.
It seems that that's why so many of the big problems that we have are difficult to resolve, because that's what we're arguing about. We're arguing about personal freedom versus common good.
Yes. Yes. I think that puts it very well. And to speak about personal freedom and individual choice on the one hand and notions of the common good on the other, just put that way, these are abstract moral and political principles, but they come alive when we connect them with the actual debates we're engaged in. For example, I was listening to the debate on the House floor Saturday night about the health care bill, which just narrowly passed the House. And, you know, they were given one-minute speeches each. But I find it interesting to listen to those speeches and to listen for the reasons. Often our political debates these days don't really seem very reflective or principled. They seem to sound more like ideological food fights on cable television. But if you listen carefully to the arguments people make for and against the health care reform, not far beneath the surface, there are these big principles of justice, including the ones, David, that you mentioned. So what really is the opposition, the principled opposition to health care reform? As I heard it, it had to do with a certain conception of individual freedom and choice. The objection was that this amounts to a government takeover of health care, and to mandate that everyone buy health care, whether they're young and healthy and don't want it, or whether they need it, is a violation of individual freedom. And to tax some people, those who are better off, to pay for health care for those who can't afford it, is a violation of individual freedom. This is the idea that lies behind much of the opposition. And arrayed against that is a claim of the common good, that what it means to be a citizen of a democratic society is to have certain obligations to one's fellow citizens, and that includes to provide a basic, decent provision so that no one who falls ill is forced to go bankrupt or to be denied treatment. So there are, even that I think can be seen in the healthcare debate, this clash between a certain notion of individual freedom. It's a market conception of freedom. I should be able to keep the money I make and decide what to do with it, arrayed against a certain conception of the common good.
It seems to me that I don't want to be overly reductionist, but that so much of political debate really does come down to this kind of tension between some notion of common good, whatever that is, and the notion of individual freedom. And it seems to me that these two things are mutually exclusive. I'm not exactly sure how you is any sort of a middle ground possible here.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're mutually exclusive for the following reason. The example I just gave from the healthcare debate is one in which a certain idea of freedom and individual choice is in tension with a certain conception of the common good. But there are rival understandings of freedom and of individual rights that often inform our debates. So I think one of the reasons that the clash between individual rights and the common good arise is that many of our debates have to do with the role of markets and market choices as against the role of government. And the healthcare debate was framed very much in that way. But take another example. This is another one I give in the book about whether people have a right to keep the money they make in the market, or whether the money that different people make, including very successful people, is due to factors over which they can't really claim credit. Take an example of a school teacher. What does the average school teacher make in the United States? It's
Probably about $20,000
well,
a year.
It's a bit higher if you look at it. It's around $42,000. Mm-hmm. What does David Letterman make?
Oh, millions, tens of millions.
His annual contract is $31 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so we could ask the question, is it just, is it fair that the average school teacher makes about $40,000 a year and Letterman makes $31 million? Now, you could say, well, we live in a market society, and the market societies are governed by the law of supply and demand, and there must be a great demand for what David Letterman does. But from the standpoint of the common good, if the test of fairness is who contributes to what we need and want as a society, what's worthwhile, then it's pretty hard to argue that Letterman is entitled to that much more than a school teacher, who, after all, contributes very powerfully to the common good. Or here's one other example. The Chief Justice of the United States, Chief Justice Roberts, makes, what do you figure he makes?
I happen to have seen you talking about this, so I think it's in six figures, like $250,000
right,
or something like that.
Right, it's a little over $200,000.
Right.
But there's another judge who makes more than him.
Yes.
Judge Judy.
Judge Judy, yes.
Makes $25 million a
yes.
year. Now, do we really think that her contribution to the common good is 100 times greater than that of the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court? Now, some would say, look, it's a matter of individual freedom, and people know what the pay is, and they choose their jobs freely, and there's no more to be said about it. That would be the idea. That would be the idea that ties justice to consent and individual choice in a kind of market sense of freedom. But it seems to me there is a further question that can be asked about both of those cases. Doesn't justice have something to do with what people deserve? And doesn't what people deserve have something to do with what they contribute to the common good? So here's another illustration of how a certain idea of freedom, a market conception of freedom, is in tension with thinking about justice from the standpoint of contribution to the common good.
We have a caller to talk with. Let us do that. We'll bring them in. There's someone who's listening this morning in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions. First, I wanted to bring up about the healthcare debate example that you used. I think there's another issue which you've left out, and that's the issue of going to the side of the common good, as you describe it, will that result in terms of healthcare, the inability of people to make individual choices for treatment that, quote, the common good has decided ought not to be available in insurance, etc., so that, for example, there are situations in the healthcare system in Canada or in Great Britain where one cannot make certain choices, even if one wants to use one's own money or a separate private insurance, because there's been decisions made about what's in the common good with the common public health care system. Now, there's a fear, and I think this is a real fear, that going towards a health care system that follows the common good will result in the inability to make certain choices in, let's say, the Medicare system in the United States, if one doesn't fall into certain categories or if one does fall into certain categories. So I'd like you to talk about that. And then I have another question which I'll ask, and then I'll get off the air. And this has to do with peace and peace between nations, and whether sometimes, and I've seen this specifically written about in terms of the situations in Africa, whether in Rwanda or even in the Sudan, whether emphasizing the so-called justice to ensure in terms of past, call it events, crimes, whatever you want to call it, emphasizing justice has hindered the ability to have present and future peace, or the other way, in order to get peace, there's been a need to be able to let go of trying to have, quote, justice or punishment.
So, right. Good. Two good questions. First on whether designing health care for the sake of the common good wouldn't restrict people's choices to be able to go out and buy certain medical procedures that they might want. I think it's true that of any healthcare system that there is rationing. Healthcare is expensive, it's a scarce good, and different systems, be they private or public or mixed, try to impose some restraints on the use of healthcare services. The real question is what should be the principle of rationing and what should be the agency of rationing. It is true that in countries that have national healthcare policies, there is tends to be a more explicit public decision about what the healthcare priorities should be. Now, the question is, the caller wonders or seems to feel that the current U.S. system, which lacks universal health care, involves greater choice and less rationing. I'm not sure that's true for the following reason. I think our system, our current system, rations access to health care as surely as do the systems with public health care systems. The only difference is that the rationing that is done of health care in our current system is done by the insurance companies and by the markets and by the inability of some people to afford various procedures. So I don't think there is a system of health care provision, public or private, that does without rationing scarce resources. I think the real question, and I think it's a question that raises issues of justice, is who should do the rationing and to what extent should it be the market and one's ability to pay and to what extent should it be a public deliberation, which would be the course with a public option. As for the tension sometimes between peace and reconciliation on the one hand and the demands of justice on the other, I think the caller raises a very good point. Societies that have experienced genocide, ethnic cleansing, civil war, slavery and segregation, and various forms of historic injustice do often have to wrestle with the extent to which they want to try to forgive and forget, if that's possible, and the demand for justice. And often insisting on punishing every last perpetrator may be so wrenching for a society that it disrupts efforts at social reconciliation. I think it's important that when we wrestle with the tension between reconciliation and justice in divided societies, that we face up to that tension. Otherwise, even if we opt to forgive a certain historic injustices, it would be seen as simply sweeping them under the rug. I think it's important that they be recognized and acknowledged, even if we don't pursue every last retributive act against the perpetrators.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We're about midway through here. We have a couple of other people who we'd like to talk to. Let me just very quickly say that our guest is Michael Sandel. He's professor of government at Harvard University, where he has taught since 1980. He's the author of many books, including the recently published book, Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? It's published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux. And in this book, he tries to do the kind of thing that he does with a course that he teaches at Harvard, a very popular course that he's been teaching for a number of years, where he tries to engage students in a conversation about big questions, the kind of things that we wrestle with today, that people have been wrestling with for a long time, trying to get them to not only tell them what they think, tell him what they think is the right thing to do, but get them to think about why it is they think that is the right thing to do. Questions are welcome. I also do want to mention that there is a public television series based on his course. It's called Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? It's being produced by WGBH, and if you're interested in that, finding out more about that show, it does have a website, justiceharvard.org, and I believe also some of his lectures are available for you to watch on the web, so if you'd like to see what it would be like, get some idea about what it would be like to be in his classroom, you can go online and do that. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Another caller here, Bridgeview, line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Good topic. Philosophy and you need to almost be a psychiatrist and kind of study the way the American psyche works to find out justice or injustice. And the reason I bring this up is it seems like I call it instead of the baby boomers, I want it. The Americans they were spoiled. We want everything and not pay for it. And when we don't get it, we want justice, and it may not be right. It may be wrong. My dad used to tell me, you know, there's right doesn't make wrong. I mean, a wrong doesn't make a right, you know, and he's right. You know, life's tough. You win some, you lose some. But with everything that's going on with the health care packages and other issues that are coming up, it's like the haves and have-nots are going at it. And it's not about what's right for everybody. It's about the have-nots wanting what the haves have without paying for it. Or what I shouldn't say paying for it. There are issues out there that we've turned into a welfare country, and it seems like every time I turn around, everybody wants to squeeze the other guy for stuff. I'm a contractor, or formerly a contractor, and the things I used to get from people trying to negotiate prices, it's not about quality anymore. I think in the last probably 7-8 years, we've gone to, I want it. At no matter cost. And in it, what it comes down to is the injustice that people do to get what they need, the suing. I have a friend of mine down the street from me who is a insurance claims adjuster, and some of the stuff that he has sent to me is just insane. And that's just the reason I say that is because it's a lot of it is because they didn't get what they want right away. They'll do whatever they can to get it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, and we'll see what you say about that. But I'll get off. Thank you.
And it makes me think of some of the things you've said about how really when one talks about justice, what it comes back around to is this question of who deserves what, or what do people deserve, and who decides that.
Yes, exactly. And the caller is pointing out that people overreach, and when, as you say, David, we debate who deserves what, there is, I suppose, a natural human tendency for people to overestimate what we ourselves deserve. But one thing that the caller's observations brought to mind about the haves and the have-nots and the scramble that's always been a part of politics for the upper hand, for the pursuit of self-interest. Notwithstanding that scramble, notwithstanding the fact that politics involves people clamoring for the best deal for themselves, we do make arguments in politics. We do try to persuade one another. And so it's that part of politics, the part having to do with argument, with persuasion, with deliberation, that brings in ideas about right and wrong and who deserves what. Take the example of the debate we had over the bailout and then the outrage over the bonuses with the Wall Street investment houses and banks. Now, there was a case where you could argue that relatively speaking, that the have-nots were being asked to subsidize the haves, these tremendously affluent bankers and investment houses on Wall Street. And the argument was made that unless we do the bailout, the whole financial system will melt down and that'll hurt everybody. So in a way, that was an argument about the common good. But it was very difficult for to make that case because it really involved the average taxpayer providing a subsidy to these Wall Street banks. And I think there was a sense of outrage, even though the bailout was enacted, sense of outrage that really does have to do with this fundamental idea, David, that you raise about who deserves what. There was a deep sense that these guys don't deserve these bailouts. They enjoyed all the profits when times are good. Why should we, the taxpayers, bail them out when things go bad? And I think that outrage has persisted because it hasn't really been adequately addressed. And I think it's contributed to an erosion of trust and confidence in government generally. I think some of the anger over the health care reform that we saw in those town meetings had to do with some lingering anger and outrage over the bailouts. Mm.
Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We'll go on to somebody on a cell phone. This is our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, great. Great talking to you. I love the program. A couple quick comments. One on what people deserve. I think sometimes we forget that people often deserve things that they don't get for one reason or another.
Yes.
You know, I think we all deserve to be in happy, healthy relationships, but that doesn't mean it's always going to happen or it's somebody else's fault if we don't get it. And then also, you were speaking on the rationing of healthcare, and I just wanted to comment that I'm self-employed part-time and then work part-time in the service industry, so I haven't had health insurance in about 3 years. And that, you know, that's rationing as well. The I think the big difference is that at least with the socialized style healthcare system, hopefully anyway, ideally, there would be debate about how it's rationed, and that would be more open.
Right.
You know, and we would understand who gets what and why, again, ideally.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what prompted me to change my views on that issue.
Could I ask you a question?
Yes.
What's your view about the healthcare reform bills that are currently being debated by Congress? Are you for them, against them, or have you not made up your mind?
Well, the older I get, the more liberal I get, I think. I used to be very ideologically kind of center right, and I just think that I've looked at and heard programs and watched PBS talk about the systems in other countries, and as far as I can see, the statistics show that works generally more efficiently, and they spend less on health care per capita, and it just seems to be a better system. So
yeah.
I'm really hoping we come up with something along those lines.
Right. Good. Yes. Well, I happen to agree with you. I think it's interesting how you've described the shift in your thinking as you've followed the healthcare debate, and people move in both directions ideologically, I think, as they get older. So it's interesting to hear about your experience.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller and mention that we're moving into about our last 15 minutes, so we have some other folks I want to get to, and we'll just take them in order and go next to Champagne on line number two. Hello.
Yeah. Let's take the big one, global warming. The way I look at it is that we also have the same thing here, don't we, the individual versus the common good. I think my question is that where is the sense of social responsibility? If we say it's the individual, what happened to the sense of social responsibility? Does that play in at all or not?
Right. I think that the idea of social responsibility has to play in to any
any attempt to address a challenge as big as global warming. One of the challenges of any attempt to mobilize large numbers of people for common purposes and projects, like reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and this is a global, not just a national challenge, is that you've got to motivate people to do it. And to motivate people for something this big requires developing a sense of social responsibility and a sense of a common ethic, a shared commitment to realize something, to undertake a project on behalf of the common good. And one of the convictions that informs the book and that I think comes up in a number of philosophers historically is that we can't really achieve a just society, we can't really succeed in acting for the sake of the common good unless we can cultivate in citizens and in ourselves a sense of responsibility for the good of the whole. And that means sometimes setting aside our own individual interests or even those of our country if we're talking about a global accord, or at least to reconceive our individual interests so that they are informed by this broader project. So often we debate about justice as a matter of who gets what, and that is a big part of justice. But another part of it is, in what spirit do we enter into public life? And to what degree can we cultivate among ourselves the civic virtues, that's an old-fashioned phrase, but the civic virtues to care about the good of the whole, not just our own individual interests.
And it seems that's something that we're not very good at. And maybe it's just that it's difficult.
It is difficult.
And it's
difficult, David, and it's... And our politics hasn't been very successful lately at inspiring a sense of common purposes and ends.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the appeal and the hope of Barack Obama as a candidate for president is that he did try to speak, and he did speak successfully, to public life as a larger moral project, as something more than simply the sum of individual interests. And so he kind of offered an ideal of what it means to be a citizen that addressed larger moral and even spiritual concerns. I think people resonated to that. I'm not sure that it's been easy for him to translate that inspirational message into the conduct of his presidency. That's a tall order. And politics at the national level is fraught with interests and lobbies and the power of money and so on. We know that. But I think that's ultimately the challenge. And I think there's a great public hunger and yearning for a public life of larger meaning and one that does take on these big questions of the common good.
All right. Let's continue and talk next with someone in Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Unsolicitedly, I'll say I oppose the bill for the same reason that Dennis Kucinich quoted today earlier. He voted against the bill, saying that $700 billion over 10 years will go into subsidizing the insurance industry. And Big Pharma, I think, gets some of that largesse, too, as opposed to actually more directly providing health care. So,
if I could just comment on that. That is the hard price that this approach pays for leaving in place, basically, the private insurance industry and trying to build a kind of universal system around it rather than doing what some European countries have done and essentially create a single-payer system. So there is a hard choice to be made there.
Well, a bad choice, in my opinion. But... Actually, I heard you at the top talk about how you regard income distribution as one of the principles of justice that you want to talk about, and I wanted you to just ask an open-ended question to address that some, and maybe even use some specific examples of how you use the strike of the lower-paid income service employees at Harvard. How did you use that as a teachable moment, for instance? And I guess I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks.
Well, the question of income distribution and the redistribution of income is one that looms large in debates about justice. Political philosophers, including contemporary political philosophers, argue both sides of that question. What's interesting is that in contemporary politics, redistribution of income has not really loomed large. In fact, if you think back to the campaign, when Barack Obama made a comment within the hearing range of this fellow, Joe the Plumber, about spreading around the wealth, it became he was accused of being a socialist. But the real issue from the standpoint of justice of the distribution of income and wealth is this question about the moral status of the market. If you believe that market outcomes are just, provided they are arrived at through free consent, then you're likely to oppose any redistribution of income and wealth as a matter of justice. But there are good reasons to question that market view of justice. And one of them is, one of them is that the talents and abilities that enable some people to make a lot of money through the market may not be wholly their own doing. In the United States, the ratio of CEO pay to that of the average worker is somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 to 1. CEOs make almost 400 times as much as the average worker. Now, that's far bigger ratio than is the case in European countries, than is the case in Japan, than even was the case in the United States back in 1980, when the ratio was something like 45 to 1. So do we really believe that that CEOs today are 8 times, 10 times as smart and hardworking as were their counterparts in 1980? Probably not. And if that's the case, then the huge discrepancies are not the doing of the CEOs themselves, not due to their great talents and their contributions, but due to the way the labor market is designed and the way CEO compensation is brought about. So the real issue in the debate over income distribution and wealth distribution is whether those who land on top morally deserve the bounty that the market heaps upon their the talents that they have to offer.
All right, another caller, line one, Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Your comments earlier about developing civic virtue and a sense of the common good strike me as based on a critique of libertarianism, and I'm kind of trying to connect the dots here. And,
yeah.
I've read some of your work, and I'm just curious if you mount a critique of libertarianism, which is one of the underpinnings of the market view of freedom.
Yes.
That's one question. The other question, and I'll hang up and listen. Do you take a particular approach to teaching your students moral reasoning? And there are different approaches, and I'm just wondering if you spend some time training them and how to go about doing that. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for the questions. In the book, I do deal with libertarianism, which is essentially an individualist, market-oriented view of freedom and of justice. And I try to give it its due and to explain it faithfully and accurately. Ultimately, I am a critic of libertarian ideas of freedom and of justice, so the caller is right to sense that. And my arguments about civic virtue and the common good are at odds with certain libertarian ideas of justice and freedom. So I do make that that argument in the book. As for exposing students, introducing students to moral reasoning, that is part of the project, that is part of the enterprise. And the way I go about it in the course is much the way I try to go about it in the book, which is to start with concrete cases, concrete moral dilemmas and political controversies on which the students have opinions, have convictions. Then draw out, as David was describing before, from the students, the reasons for the opinions they have on this or that concrete case, whether it's healthcare or affirmative action or income redistribution or same-sex marriage, whatever the issue may be, the justice or injustice of torture, the torture debate would be another. So I try then to draw out the reasons and then to invite students to test those reasons by confronting them with another case, another example that might pressure those reasons or might call into question the principles that seemed to work in the earlier case. And that's the way I think, at least one way of going about moral reasoning and also political deliberation, to move back and forth between the opinions and convictions we have on concrete cases, political, legal, moral controversies, and the principles that we appeal to explain those reasons and to justify them. And so that's basically how I go about teaching moral reasoning in the course, and also how I try to make moral and political philosophy inviting and accessible to general readers in the book.
All right. At least one more caller. Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes, I'll give a wide sweep. We have Western colonialism adopted from the old world, spread around the world, and the thing that occurs to me when we have Western or semi-Western or the elites who have gourmet foods and the bottom of the heap, they're eating dirt cookies in Africa. Thank you.
Well, it is certainly looking at the vast inequality of income and wealth and opportunity across the globe. It's certainly very difficult to conclude that those inequalities, especially where they result in crushing poverty in some parts of the world, very difficult to conclude that that vast inequality is anything other than unjust. And there is not a single theory of justice that would condemn those global inequalities and deprivations. It's possible to explain the sense in which that's unjust from a range of philosophical perspectives, utilitarian, freedom-based conceptions, and also conceptions that appeal to the common good. Those are the three broad categories or families of theories of justice that that the book is organized around: utility, seeking the greatest good for the greatest number; freedom, respecting individual rights and choice; and civic virtue and the common good. I think that from any one of those three perspectives, it's possible to explain the sense of injustice that we all, I think, recognize when confronted with the kind of deprivation and global inequality that the caller describes.
All right, and we'll try one more. Cell phone here, line one. Hello.
One small point. A caller called earlier and was talking about how his center-right philosophy had shifted, you know, over the past few years, and now he was in favor of health care reform. But it kind of bears noting that he doesn't have the health care himself. And one of the things that I think is such an important dimension to that particular debate is, well, A, it's happening to more people, but B, it seems there are a lot of people who are not willing to consider that the person who doesn't have health care isn't somehow, you know, responsible, that it's his fault. If you lose your job, you lose your health care. That's just the way it happens in the United States. You might be able to pay for it for a while, but then you lose it. And it seems that there's this intent, this willful intent, not to consider why it happened to someone else until it happens to you. And I think that fuels a lot of impetus. Maybe you've covered that obliquely with other topics, but maybe you could touch on that a little bit more directly.
It's a very good observation. I think that much of the resistance to approaches, whether to healthcare or other policies, in the name of the common good or in the name of some kind of ethic of solidarity or sharing, much of the opposition derives from the idea that those who land on top or who have good healthcare morally deserve it. It's their doing. And those who lack it or who wind up in some respect on the bottom, they're morally responsible for that condition. And that's one of the assumptions that I think we need to critically examine. To what extent does our lot in life reflect our choices, our doing, and to what extent is it due to forces beyond our control? If we have time, David, can I tell a quick anecdote?
If you can do it in about 30 seconds, is
all
that
right.
Enough?
They say birth order matters a lot to ethic and striving. And I tell this during the book in class. I ask the students to raise your hand, those of you who are first in birth order. About 75% to 80% of the hands go up. Mm-hmm. And that may have something to do with this whole debate raised by the caller about the morally arbitrary or contingent aspects that contribute to people's success in life or ability to strive and to work hard.
If you would like to read more about this subject here, what is the right thing to do and how people think about that, the book to look at is Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do, by our guest Michael Sandel. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Michael Sandel is professor of government at Harvard University, where he teaches the Justice course. And it is the basis for a public television series that's running on many stations, including ours, Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do. You can find out more by going to the website justiceharvard.org or go to our website and look at the television schedule. It is running on one of our digital channels on early Sunday evenings. And Professor Sandel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, David. My pleasure.
Support for WILL comes from the Champaign County Humane Society, promoting animal welfare since 1951. Pet adoptions are available from the Humane Society, a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll deductions or donations at work, on the web at cs-il.org. This is WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We will break, as we usually do at this point, for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Quite a bit of green on the screen ahead of tomorrow's crop production and WASD reports. Let's go ahead and look at particulars in Kansas City. December wheat now trading 507.5, up 6.5. March at 523.5, up 6.25. May 534, up 5. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 502.75, up 5.5. March 523, up 5.75. December corn 376.5, up 9.5. March 390.5, up 9.5. May $4, up 9. July 407, up 7.5. December crude 79.80, up $2.37. The December RBOB at, well, not trading, but the December ethanol contract at 1.